This is Audible.
Silence by Shusaku Endo. Translated from the Japanese by William Johnston and with a foreword by Martin Scorsese. Read by David Holt. Foreword. How do you tell the story of Christian faith? The difficulty, the crisis of believing. How do you describe the struggle? There have been many great 20th century novelists drawn to the subject. Graham Greene, of course, and François Mauriac. Georges Bernanos, and from his own very particular perspective, Shusaku Endo. When I use the word particular, I am not referring to the fact that Endo was Japanese. In fact, it seems to me that Silence, his greatest novel, and one that has become increasingly precious to me as the years have gone by, is precisely about the particular and the general. And it is finally about the first overwhelming the second. Endo himself had great difficulty reconciling his Catholic faith with Japanese culture. So it was not historical research, but his own experience that drew him to the stories of the Portuguese missionaries of the 17th century, who were forced to apostatize. He understood the conflict of faith, the necessity of belief fighting the voice of experience. The voice that always urges the faithful, the questioning faithful, to adapt their beliefs to the world they inhabit, their culture. Christianity is based on faith. But if you study its history, you see that it's had to adapt itself over and over again, always with great difficulty, in order that faith might flourish. That's a paradox, and it can be an extremely painful one. On the face of it, believing and questioning are antithetical. Yet I believe that they go hand in hand. One nourishes the other. Questioning may lead to great loneliness, but if it coexists with faith, true faith, abiding faith, it can end in the most joyful sense of communion. It's this painful, paradoxical passage from certainty to doubt, to loneliness to communion, that Endo understands so well and renders so clearly, carefully and beautifully in Silence. Sebastian Rodriguez represents what you might call the best and the brightest of the Catholic faith. There were once men of the Church, the old priest of Torcy tells the young, sickly priest of Ambricourt in Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest, and Rodriguez would most certainly have been one of those men, stalwart, unbending in his will and his resolve, unshakable in his faith, if he had stayed in Portugal, that is. Instead, he is tested in a very special and especially painful way. He is placed in the middle of another hostile culture, during a late stage in a protracted effort to rid itself of Christianity. Rodriguez believes, with all his heart, that he will be the hero of a Western story that we all know very well, the Christian allegory. He will be the Christ figure with his own Gethsemane, a patch of woods, and his own Judas, a miserable wretch named Kichijiro. In fact, this is the fate that befalls his fellow missionary, Father Garp. And then slowly, masterfully, Endo reverses the tide. Why am I being kept alive? Rodriguez wonders. Where is my martyrdom, my glorious martyrdom? His Japanese captors have a keener understanding of Christianity than he realizes, and he is given a different role altogether, although no less meaningful. Silence is the story of a man who learns, so painfully, that God's love is more mysterious than he knows, that he leaves much more to the ways of men than we realize, and that he is always present, even in his silence. For me, it is the story of one who begins on the path of Christ and who ends replaying the role of Christianity's greatest villain, Judas. He almost literally follows in his footsteps. In doing so, he comes to understand the role of Judas. This is one of the most painful dilemmas in all of Christianity. What was Judas's role? What was expected of him by Christ? What is expected of him by us today? With the discovery of the Gospel of Judas, these questions have become even more pressing. Endo looks at the problem of Judas more directly than any other artist I know. He understood that, in order for Christianity to live, to adapt itself to other cultures and historical moments, it needs not just the figure of Christ, but the figure of Judas as well. I picked up this novel for the first time almost 20 years ago. I've reread it countless times since, and I am now preparing to adapt it as a film. It has given me a kind of sustenance that I have found in only a very few works of art. I leave you with Silence by the great Shusaku Endo. Martin Scorsese. Historical note. Christianity was first introduced to Japan by Francis Xavier, one of the co-founders of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuit order, and two colleagues in 1549. For the next 60 years, the Christian mission largely found favour in the Japanese court, although there were problems, notably the expulsion order of 1587 by the shogun Hideyoshi and his later crucifixion of 26 Japanese Christians and European missionaries. In spite of this, by 1600 there were an estimated 300,000 Christian converts living in Japan. However, the arrival of English and Dutch Protestants, antagonistic to the Spanish-sponsored Jesuits, combined with the coming to power of the shogun Ieyasu, who wanted to destroy Christian influence in Japan, turned the situation violently against the Japanese Christians. In 1614, a second edict of expulsion was issued, this time ruthlessly enforced by Ieyasu and his successors. From 1614 to 1640, it is estimated that between 5,000 and 6,000 Christians were killed. After it was noted that burning offenders alive gave them a glorious martyrdom, the use of torture was introduced in an attempt to force Christians to apostatize, renounce their faith. In 1632, the Catholic world was shocked by the news that Father Cristóvão Ferreira, the Portuguese provincial and leader of the Jesuit mission in Japan, had apostatized and was even collaborating with the Japanese. By 1643, when Silence is set, Christianity only survived in underground communities and was ruthlessly suppressed by the authorities wherever it was found. Prologue. News reached the church in Rome. Cristóvão Ferreira, sent to Japan by the Society of Jesus in Portugal after undergoing the torture of the pit at Nagasaki, had apostatized. An experienced missionary held in the highest respect, he had spent 33 years in Japan, had occupied the high position of provincial, and had been a source of inspiration to priests and faithful alike. He was a theologian, too, of considerable ability, and in the time of persecution he had secretly made his way into the Kamigata region to pursue his apostolic work. From here, the letters he sent to Rome overflowed with a spirit of indomitable courage. It was unthinkable that such a man would betray the faith, however terrible the circumstances in which he was placed. In the Society of Jesus, as well as the Church at large, people asked themselves if the whole thing were not just a fictitious report invented by the Dutch or the Japanese. Not that the Church at Rome was ignorant of the straitened circumstances in which the Japanese mission was situated. Letters from the missionaries had left no room for doubt. From 1587, the regent Hideyoshi, reversing the policy of his predecessor, had initiated a frightful persecution of Christianity. It first began when 26 priests and faithful were punished at Nishizaka in Nagasaki. And following on this, Christians all over the country were evicted from their households, tortured, and cruelly put to death. The shogun Tokugawa pursued the same policy, ordering the expulsion of all the missionaries from Japan in the year 1614. Reports from the missionaries tell of how on the 6th and 7th of October of this same year, 70 priests, both Japanese and foreign, were herded together at Kibachi in Kyushu and forced to board 5 junks bound for Macau and Manila. Then they sailed into exile. It was rainy that day, and the sea was grey and stormy as the ships, drenched by the rain, made their way out of the harbour, passed beside the promontory, and disappeared beyond the horizon. Flaunting this severe decree of exile, however, 37 priests refused to abandon their flock and secretly remained hiding in Japan. And Ferreira was one of these underground priests. He continued to inform his superiors by letter of the capture of the missionaries and the Christians, and of the punishment to which they were subjected. Today, there is still extant a letter he wrote from Nagasaki on March the 22nd, 1632, to the visitor Andrew Palmero, giving an exhaustive description of the conditions of that time. "In my former letter, I informed your reverence of the situation of Christianity in this country, and now I will go on to tell you of what has happened since then. Everything has ended up in new persecution, new repression, new suffering. Let me begin my account with the story of five religious who from the year 1629 were apprehended for their faith. Their names are Bartholomew Gutierrez, Francisco de Jesus, Vincente de San Antonio of the Order of St. Augustine, Antonio Ishida of our own society, and a Franciscan, Gabriel de Santa Magdalena. The magistrate of Nagasaki, Takenaka Unime, tried to make them apostatize and to ridicule our holy faith and its adherents, for he hoped in this way to destroy the courage of the faithful. But he quickly realized that words alone would never shake the resolution of these priests, so he was forced to adopt a different course of action, namely immersion in the hell of boiling water at Unzen. He gave orders that the five priests be brought to Unzen and tortured until such time as they should renounce their faith. But on no account were they to be put to death. In addition to the five priests, Beatrice da Costa, wife of Antonio da Silva, and her daughter Maria were to be tortured, since they too, in spite of all attempts at persuasion, had refused to give up their faith. On December the 3rd, the party left Nagasaki for Unzen. The two women were carried in litters, while the five men were mounted on horses. And so they bade farewell. Arriving at the port some distance away, their arms and hands were bound, their feet were shackled, and they were put on board a ship and tightly tied to its side. That evening, they reached the harbour of Obama at the foot of Unzen. And the next day, they climbed the mountain where the seven, one by one, were thrust into a tiny hut. Day and night they remained there in confinement, their feet shackled and their arms bound, while around them guards kept watch. The road to the mountain, too, was lined with guards, and without formal permission from the officials, no one was permitted to pass that way. The next day, the torture began in the following way. One by one, the seven were taken apart from the surrounding people, brought to the edge of the seething lake and shown the boiling water casting its spray high into the air, and then they were urged to abandon the teaching of Christ, or else they would experience in their very bodies the terrible pain of the boiling water which lay before them. The cold weather made the steam arising from the bubbling lake look terrible indeed, and the very sight of it would make a strong man faint were it not for the grace of God. But every one of them, strengthened by God's grace, showed remarkable courage and even asked to be tortured, firmly declaring that they would never abandon their holy faith. Hearing this dauntless reply, the officials tore off the prisoners' clothes, bound them hand and foot to posts, and scooping up the boiling water in ladles, poured it over their naked bodies. These ladles were perforated and full of holes, so that this process took a considerable time and the suffering was prolonged. The heroes of Christ bore this terrible torment without flinching. Only the young Maria, overcome with the excess of her suffering, fell to the ground in agony. "She has apostatized! She has apostatized!" they cried, and carrying her to the hut, they promptly sent her back to Nagasaki. Maria denied that she had wished to apostatize. Indeed, she even pleaded to be tortured with her mother and the rest, but they paid no attention to her prayers. The other six remained on the mountain for 33 days. During that time, the priests Antonio and Francisco, as well as Beatrice, were each tortured 6 times in the boiling water. Father Vincente was tortured 4 times, Fathers Palmero and Gabriel 2 times. Yet in all this, Not one of them so much as breathed a groan or a sigh. Fathers Antonio and Francisco, as well as Beatrice da Costa in particular, undaunted by tortures, threats and pleadings of all kind, displayed a courage worthy of a man. In addition to the torture of the boiling water, she was subjected to the further ignominy of being obliged to stand for hours upon a small rock, exposed to the jeering and insults of the crowd. But even when the frenzy of her persecutors reached its zenith, she did not flinch. The others, being weak in health, could not be punished too severely, since the wish of the magistrate was not to put them to death, but to make them apostatize. Indeed, for this reason, he went so far as to bring a doctor to the mountain to tend their wounds. At last, however, Unamé realized that he would never win. On the contrary, his followers, seeing the courage of the priests, told him that all the springs in Unzen would run dry before men of such power could be persuaded to change their minds. So he decided to bring them back to Nagasaki. On January the 5th, he confined Beatrice to a house of ill fame, while the priests he lodged in the local prison, and there they still are. This whole struggle has had the effect of spreading our doctrine among the multitude and of strengthening the faith of our Christians. All has turned out contrary to the intentions of the tyrant. Such was Ferreira's letter. The church at Rome could not believe that this man, however terrible the torture, could be induced to renounce his faith and grovel before the infidel. In 1635, four priests gathered around Father Rubino in Rome. Their plan was to make their way into a Japan in the throes of persecution, in order to carry on an underground missionary apostolate and to atone for the apostasy of Ferreira, which had so wounded the honour of the church. At first, their wild scheme did not win the consent of their superiors. Though sympathizing with the ardour and apostolic zeal which prompted such a plan, the church authorities felt reluctant to send any more priests to such a country and to a mission fraught with such peril. On the other hand, this was a country in which, from the time of Francis Xavier, the good seed had been most abundantly sown. To leave it without leaders and to abandon the Christians to their fate was something unthinkable. Furthermore, in the Europe of that time, the fact that Ferreira had been forced to abandon his faith in this remote country at the periphery of the world was not simply the failure of one individual, but a humiliating defeat for the faith itself and for the whole of Europe. Such was the way of thinking that prevailed. And so, after all sorts of troubles and difficulties, Father Rubino and his four companions were finally permitted to set sail. In addition to this group, however, there were three other priests planning to enter Japan secretly in the same way, but these were Portuguese, and their reason was different. They had been Ferreira's students, and had studied under him at the ancient monastery of Campolide. For these three men, Francisco Garp, Juan de Santa Marta, and Sebastian Rodriguez, it was impossible to believe that their much-admired teacher, Ferreira, faced with the possibility of a glorious martyrdom, had grovelled like a dog before the infidel. And in these sentiments they spoke for the clergy of Portugal. They would go to Japan. They would investigate the matter with their own eyes. But here, as in Italy, their superiors were slow to give consent. At length, however, overcome by the ardent importunity of the young man, they agreed to this dangerous mission to Japan. This was in the year 1637. Consequently, the three young priests set about preparing their long and arduous journey. It was customary at that time for the Portuguese missionaries who went to the Orient to join the fleet which went from Lisbon to India, and the departure of this Indian fleet was one of the most exciting events of the year in Lisbon. Before the eyes of the three men there arose in vivid colours the spectacle of an Orient which was literally the end of the earth, and of a Japan which was its uttermost limit. As one opened the map, one saw the shape of Africa, then India, and then the innumerable islands and countries of Asia were all spread out, and then, at the northeast extremity, looking just like a caterpillar, was the tiny shape of Japan. To get to this country one must first go to Goa in India, Then over miles and miles of sea, for a period of weeks and months, one must go on and on. From the time of St. Francis Xavier, Goa had been the gateway to all missionary labour in the East. It had two seminaries where students from all parts of Asia studied and where the European missionaries learned about conditions in the country for which they were bound. Here, missionaries sometimes had to wait for 6 months or even a year for a ship that would take them to the country to which they were destined. The three priests strove with all their might to learn what they could about conditions in Japan. Fortunately, there were many reports sent from Japan by Portuguese missionaries from the time of Luis Froas, and these told of how the new shogun Iemitsu had adopted a policy of repression even more cruel than that of his father or grandfather. Especially in Nagasaki, from the year 1629, the magistrate Takinama Unime had inflicted upon the Christians the most inhuman and atrocious sufferings, immersing them in pools of boiling water and urging them to renounce their faith and change their religion. It was said that in one single day the number of victims sometimes reached no less than 60 or 70. Since it was Ferreira himself who had sent this news, there could be no mistake about its reliability. In any case, the new missionaries realized that they must have from the beginning the realization and conviction that the end of their arduous journey might bring them up against a fate more terrible than any of the sufferings they had endured on the way. Sebastian Rodriguez, born in 1610 in the well-known mining town of Taxco, entered religious life at the age of 17. Juan de Santa Marta and Francisco Garp, both friends of Rodriguez, also studied with him at the seminary of Campolide. From their early days at the minor seminary, they had spent their days sitting at their desks in study, and they all had vivid memories of their old teacher Ferreira, from whom they had learned theology. And this same Ferreira was now somewhere in Japan. Had that face, with its clear blue eyes and soft radiant light, had it been changed by the hands of the Japanese torturers? This was the question they asked themselves. They could not believe that this face could now be distorted because of insults heaped on it, nor could they believe that Ferreira had turned his back on God and cast away that gentle charity that characterized his every action. Rodriguez and his companions wanted by all means to get to Japan and learn the truth about the fate of Ferreira. On March the 25th, 1638, the Indian fleet sailed out from the River Tagus to a salvo of guns from the fortress of Belem. On board the Santa Isabella were the three missionaries who, after receiving a blessing from the bishop, João Dasco, had boarded the commander's ship. As they reached the mouth of the Brown River and plunged into the blue noonday sea, they leaned against the side of the ship, watching the promontory and the mountain gleaming like gold. There were the red walls of the farmhouses, the church. From the church tower, the tolling of the bell which bade farewell to the departing ships was carried out into the sea. Now for their journey around Africa to India. 3 days after departure, they hit up against a terrible storm on the west coast of Africa. On April the 2nd, they reached the island of Porto Santo, sometime later Madeira. On the 6th, they arrived at the Canary Islands, where they encountered ceaseless rain pouring down from a sky which contained no breath of wind. In the utterly windless calm, the heat was unbearable. And then, in addition to everything, disease broke out. On the Santa Isabella alone, more than 100 victims lay moaning on the deck and in the bunks below. Rodriguez and his companion, together with the crew, hastened around, tending the sick and helping to bleed them. July 25th, the Feast of St. James. The ship at last rounded the Cape of Good Hope. On this day, a violent wind again arose, so that the mast of the ship was broken and crashed down on the deck with a rending sound. Even the sick and Rodriguez and his companions were summoned up to rescue the foresail from the same peril. But scarcely had they succeeded in their attempt when the ship ran on a rock. If the other ships had not been there to help, the Santa Isabella would probably have sunk there and then. After the storm, the wind again calmed down. The sail lay lifeless. Only its pitch-black shadow fell upon the faces and bodies of the sick, who lay like dead men on the deck. And so the days passed, one by one, with the glaring heat of the sun beating down upon a sea which had not so much as a swell of the waves. All these mishaps prolonged the journey, so that food and water became scarce. But at last, on October the 9th, they reached their destination, Goa. After arrival, they were able to get more detailed news about Japan than had been possible at home. They were told that since January of the year in which they had set sail, 35,000 Christians had caused an insurrection at Shimabara, and in the ensuing bloody conflict with the forces of the Bakufu, the rebels had been butchered to the last man. Men and women, young and old, all alike had been slain. As a result of the war, the whole district was so desolate that scarcely a human shadow could be seen, while the remnants of the Christians were being hunted down one by one. The news, however, which gave the greatest shock to Rodriguez and his companions, was that, as a result of this war, Japan had cut all trade relations and intercourse with their country. Portuguese ships were forbidden to enter the harbours of Japan. It was with the realization that they could not be brought to Japan in a Portuguese ship that the three priests reached Macau. They felt desperate. The town of Macau, in addition to being the base of Portuguese operations in the Far East, was a base for trade between China and Japan. Consequently, if they waited here, there was the possibility that some stroke of good fortune might help them on their way. Immediately on arrival, they received clear-cut advice from the visitor Valignano, who was in Macau at that time. Missionary work in Japan, he said, was now out of question, nor had he any intention of sending missionaries to a country fraught with such dangers. From the time of the outbreak of persecution in Japan, it should be said, the whole administration of the Japanese province of the Society of Jesus had been entrusted to this superior, Valignano, who 10 years before had founded at Macau a college for the formation of missionaries bound for China and Japan. In regard to Ferreira, whom the three men intended to seek out after arrival in Japan, Valignano gave the following report. From the year 1633, all news from the underground mission had come to an abrupt and drastic end. Dutch sailors, returned to Macau from Nagasaki, related that Ferreira had been taken and tortured in the pit. After that, the whole matter was obscure, and investigation of the true facts was impossible. This was because the Dutch had left on the very day that Ferreira had been suspended in the pit. The only thing that could be said with certainty was that Ferreira had been cross-examined by the newly appointed magistrate Inoue, the Lord of Chikugo. In any case, the Macau mission could in no way agree to priests travelling to a Japan in such conditions. This was the frank opinion of Valignano. Today, we can read some of the letters of Sebastian Rodriguez in the library of the Portuguese Institute for the Historical Study of Foreign Lands. The first of these begins at the time when he and his companions heard from Valignano about the situation in Japan. Chapter 1. Letter of Sebastian Rodriguez. Pax Christi. Praised be Christ. I have already told you about how we arrived at Goa last year on October the 9th, and now on May the 1st we have reached Macau. Amidst all the difficulties and privations of the journey, Juan de Santa Marta became utterly exhausted, and it looked as if he was getting malaria, so only Francis Garp and myself are working with all our strength at the missionary college here. We certainly received a wonderful welcome. The problem is, however, that Father Valignano, rector of the college, who has been here for 10 years, has been utterly opposed to our journey to Japan. In his room overlooking the bay, he spoke to us at length, and this is the gist of what he said. I am obliged to refuse to send any more missionaries to Japan. The sea journey is extremely dangerous for Portuguese ships, and you will encounter all sorts of obstacles before even setting foot in the country. His opposition is not altogether unreasonable in view of the fact that since 1636 The Japanese government, suspecting that the Portuguese were in some way connected with the Shimabara rebellion, has completely cut all commercial relationship with them. Not only this, but in the journey from Macau, the seas neighbouring on Japan are infested by English and Dutch warships, which open fire on our trading ships. And yet our secret mission could, with God's help, turn out successful, said Juan de Santa Marta, blinking his eyes fervently. In that stricken land, the Christians have lost their priests and are like a flock of sheep without a shepherd. Someone must go to give them courage and to ensure that the tiny flame of faith does not die out. At these words, a shadow passed over Valignano's face and he remained silent. No doubt to this very day he was deeply troubled by the dilemma of his duty as a superior and the fate of the unfortunate persecuted Christians. And so the old man said no word, resting his forehead on his hands. From his room the harbour of Macau could be seen in the distance. The sea was red in the evening sun. Black junks floated on the water, scattered here and there like black smudges. And one more point. We have an added duty. We want to find out the truth about our teacher Ferreira. About Ferreira we have had no further news. The reports about him are vague. Anyhow, at present we don't have any plans for investigating the truth or falsity of what has been said about him. Is he alive? Even that we don't know. Valignano raised his head and heaved a deep sigh as he spoke. The reports he sent me regularly from the year 1633 have come to a sudden end. Whether he unhappily got sick and died, whether he is lying in the prison of the infidel, whether, as you are imagining, he won a glorious martyrdom, or whether he is still alive, trying to send some report but unable to do so, about this at present we can say nothing. Valignano did not so much as utter a word about rumours that Ferreira had succumbed beneath the torture of his enemies. Like us, he was loath to attribute such fanciful charges to his old friend. Moreover, and now Valignano spoke with some emphasis, in Japan there has now appeared a person who is indeed a terror for the Christians. His name is Inoue. This was the first time we had heard the name of Inoue. Valignano went on to say that in comparison with the savagery of Inoue, someone like Takenaka, the former magistrate of Nagasaki who had butchered so many Christians, was no more than a simple-minded person. And so to imprint on our memories the name of this Japanese, whom we would undoubtedly meet after landing in Japan, we repeated the unfamiliar sounds again and again, Inoue. From the last report sent by the Christians in Kyushu, Valignano had a good deal of knowledge about this man. Since the rebellion of Shimabara, he had become, for all practical purposes, the architect of the Christian persecution. Quite unlike his predecessor, Takenaka, he was cunning as a serpent, so that the Christians who until now had not flinched at threats and tortures succumbed one by one to his cunning wiles. And the sad fact, went on Valignano, is that he was formerly of our faith. He is even baptized. About this persecutor, I will probably be able to give you more information later on, but what I want to tell you just now is that Valignano, prudent superior though he is, was finally moved by our pleading, especially by that of Garp, and consented to our secret mission to Japan. So now the die is cast. For the conversion of Japan and the glory of God, we have somehow made our way to the east. Now we face a future which is certainly fraught with even greater perils and hardships than that sea journey around Africa and across the Indian Ocean. But if you are persecuted in one town, flee to another. And within my heart there constantly arise the words of the Apocalypse that honour and glory and power belong to God alone. As I have already told you, Macau is at the mouth of the great river Chukiang. It is built on one of the many islands with which the entrance to the bay is studded, and like all the towns of the east, there is no wall surrounding it, so that it is impossible to say where the city boundaries are. The Chinese houses stretch out like dust. But anyhow, no matter how many towns and cities of our country you imagine, you can never get a picture of what it is like. The population is said to be about 20,000, but this number is almost certainly false. The only things here that might recall our own country are the governor's palace, the Portuguese warehouses, and the cobbled roads. A fortress with cannons stands facing out into the bay, but fortunately, until this day, the cannons have never had to go into action. The greater part of the Chinese show no interest in our teaching. On this point, Japan is undoubtedly, as St. Francis Xavier said, the country in the Orient most suited to Christianity. However, ironically enough, as a result of the Japanese government's forbidding ships of its own country to go to foreign lands, the monopoly of the silk trade in the whole Far East has now fallen into the hands of the Portuguese merchants in Macau, so that the total income of this import is expected to rise to 400 seraphim, as opposed to 100 seraphim last year and the year before. Today, I have wonderful news for you. Yesterday, we at last succeeded in meeting a Japanese. Formerly, it seems that quite a number of Japanese religious and merchants came to Macau. But with the closing of their country, such visits were brought to an end, and even the few who were here returned to their own country. Even when we asked Valignano, we got the answer that there were no Japanese in this town, and yet, quite by chance, we found that there was a Japanese living in the midst of the Chinese in this town. Let me tell you how we came to meet him. Yesterday, an awfully rainy day, we visited the Chinese sector of the town to see if we could somehow get a ship bound secretly for Japan. We wanted to find a captain and sailors. Macau in the rain. The rain makes this wretched town even more wretched. The whole place was shrouded in ashen grey, while the Chinese, huddled in little houses that looked like dog kennels, left the dirty streets so deserted that there was not a shadow of life in them. As I look at such streets, I think, I wonder why, of the mystery of human life. And then I grow sad. Going to the house of the Chinese, to whom we had an introduction, we spoke about our business, and he promptly told us that there was here in Macau a Japanese who wanted to return to his native country. In answer to our request, his little boy went in search of the Japanese. What am I to say about this man? This first Japanese I ever met in my life. Reeling from excess of alcohol, a drunken man staggered into the room. About 28 or 29 years of age, he was dressed in rags. His name was Kichijiro. When finally he answered our questions, we learned that he was a fisherman from the district of Hizen near Nagasaki. Before the famous Shimabara insurrection, he had been adrift on the sea and had been picked up by a Portuguese ship. Whether or not it was due to his drunkenness, I do not know, but there was a crafty look on his face, and as he spoke he would roll his eyes. "Are you a Christian?" The question came from Garp, but the fellow suddenly shut up like a clam. We could not understand why Garp's question should make him so unhappy. At first he did not want to talk at all, but at length, yielding to our entreaties, he began bit by bit to tell the story of the Christian persecution in Kyushu. And here it is. In the village of Kurosaki, in Hizen, he had witnessed the spectacle of 24 Christians being subjected to the water punishment by the local daimyo. Wooden stakes were fixed in the sea at the water's edge, and the Christians were bound to them. When the tide came in, the water would reach up to a certain mark and then recede. The Christians gradually became utterly exhausted, and after about a week they died in the most terrible agony. Did even Nero of Rome devise such a cruel method of death? As our conversation went on, we noticed a strange thing. While Kichijiro described this hair-raising spectacle, his face became distorted. Then suddenly he lapsed into silence. He shook his hand as though some terrible memory rose up from the past to haunt him. I wonder if among those 20 or so Christians who underwent the water torture there were some of his friends and acquaintances. Perhaps we had put our finger on an open wound which should not have been touched. "Well, anyhow, you are a Christian, aren't you?" Again, Garp put the question persistently. You are, aren't you? I'm not, said Kichijiro, shaking his head. No, I'm not. Anyhow, you want to go back to Japan. We have money to buy a ship and to get together a captain and sailors, so if you would like to return to your country... At these words, those Japanese eyes, drunken and dirty yellow, flashed craftily, and, remaining squatting on his knees in a corner of the room, with trembling voice, as though he were speaking in self-defence, he begged to be allowed to be returned to his own country, if only to see again his beloved relatives who remained at home. Thus began our dealings with this jittery fellow. In the dimly lit and dirty room, a fly kept buzzing around and around. On the floor lay the empty sake bottles from which he had drunk. But anyhow, it is good to have this fellow. Once we land in Japan, we won't know right from left. Someone will have to shelter us. We will have to get in contact with Christians who can protect us. So now we can use this man as our first guide. For a long time, Kichijiro sat facing the wall, clasping his knees and thinking deeply about the terms we now offered. Then he agreed. For him it is an adventure fraught with danger, but I suppose he feels that if he misses this chance he will never again be able to get back to Japan. Anyhow, thanks to Father Valignano, it looks as if we are going to get hold of a big junk. Yet how frail and passing are the plans of men. Today we got news that the ship is eaten up by white ants, and here it is terribly difficult to get hold of iron and pitch. Every day I keep writing this report bit by bit so that it looks like a diary without a date. Please be patient in reading it. A week ago I told you that the junk we had succeeded in getting hold of was almost consumed by white ants, but now, thanks to God, we have found a method of overcoming this difficulty. We are going to seal up the inside and then set sail for Taiwan. Then, if this emergency measure looks like holding out longer, we will go straight on to Japan. We ask for God's protection that we do not run into any big storm in the East China Sea. This time, I have bad news for you. I told you that Santa Marta, completely exhausted by the long, painful sea journey, looked like catching malaria. Now, once again, he has been seized by a severe fever, accompanied by shivering all over his body. He is in bed in one of the rooms of the college. You, who knew him in his former vigorous health, cannot imagine how wretchedly thin and broken down he has become. His eyes are bloodshot and dim, and if you put a wet towel on his head, it becomes warm as though it had been immersed in hot water. To go to Japan in such a condition is simply unthinkable. Valignano says that unless we leave him here for treatment, he cannot give permission for the journey of the other two. We go first, said Garp, to console Marta. We'll prepare the way so that you can come afterwards when you get better. But can anyone predict what will happen? Perhaps he will live a safe and happy life, while we, like so many other Christians, will be captured by the infidel. Marta remained silent, his cheeks and chin covered with a thick stubble, and he stared at the window. What was in his mind? You who have known him for so long can certainly understand his feelings. The day when we boarded ship, received the blessing of Bishop Dasko, and sailed out of the river Tagus, was followed by the long, terrible journey. Our ship had been visited by thirst and sickness. And why did we endure all this? Why did we make our way to this crumbling town in the Far East? We priests are in some ways a sad group of men. Born into the world to render service to mankind, there is no one more wretchedly alone than the priest who does not measure up to his task. Marta, in particular, since our arrival in Goa, had a very special devotion to St. Francis Xavier. Every day, while praying at the shrine of the saint in India, he had prayed that he might go to Japan. Every day we keep praying that his health may be restored as soon as possible, but he makes no progress. Yet God bestows upon man a better fate than human knowledge could possibly think of or devise. Our departure draws near. Only 2 weeks remain. Perhaps God, in his omnipotence, will miraculously make all things well. The repair of the ship is proceeding rapidly. The new boards we put in after the trouble from the white ants make it look completely different. It looks as if the 25 sailors that Valignano found for us will bring us to the sea near Japan. These Chinese look thin and wasted, like sick men who have not eaten for months, but the power of their wiry hands is incredible. With these thin arms, they can lift the heaviest food boxes with ease. Their arms look like iron pokers. Anyhow, we are only waiting for a suitable wind to set sail. As for our Japanese, Kichijiro, he mingles with the Chinese sailors, carries baggage and helps with the mending of the sail. But we are missing no chance of watching closely the character of this Japanese, upon whom our whole future fate may depend. By now we have come to realize what a cunning fellow he is. And his cunning comes from weakness of character. Listen to what happened the other day. When the eyes of the Chinese overseer were upon him, he made a show of working with all his might. But when the overseer went away, he immediately began to idle. At first the other sailors said nothing, but at length they were able to put up with it no longer and beat him soundly. That in itself is not too important, but what astonished us was that when he was struck down and severely kicked by three sailors, he grew deadly pale and, kneeling on the sand where he had fallen, pleaded for pardon in the most ugly way you could imagine. Such conduct is pretty far from anything you could call Christian patience, but this weakling's cowardice is just like that. Raising his face that had been buried in the sand, he shouted out something in Japanese. His nose and cheeks were covered with sand, and a dirty spittle ran down from his mouth. Now we get some idea of why he suddenly shut up like a clam when we first mentioned the Japanese Christians. Perhaps whenever he speaks, he has a dreadful fear of his own words. Be that as it may, this one-sided fight was brought to an end when we finally intervened on his behalf, and so all became quiet. Since that time, Kichijiro greets us with a servile grin. "Are you really a Japanese? Honestly, are you?" It was a typical Garp question, and not without a touch of bitterness. But Kichijiro, with a look of astonishment, asserted emphatically that he was. Garp had too credulously taken at its face value the talk of so many missionaries about this nation whose people don't even fear death. It is true, of course, that there are Japanese who have endured torture for 5 days on end without wavering in their fidelity, but there are also cowardly weaklings like Kichijiro. And it is to such a man that we have to entrust ourselves after reaching Japan. He has promised to put us in touch with Christians who will give us shelter, but now that I see his way of acting, I wonder how much he can be trusted. But don't think that because I write in this way we have lost our energy and enthusiasm. On the contrary, when I reflect that I have entrusted my future to a fellow like Kichijiro, I cannot help laughing. When you come to think of it, our Lord himself entrusted his destiny to untrustworthy people. In any case, in our present circumstances, there is no alternative but to trust Kichijiro, so let's do so. Only one thing is really disconcerting. He is a terrible drunkard. After his day's work, he uses every penny he has received from the overseer on sake. His way of acting when drunk is unspeakable. I can only conclude that he has some haunting memory, something that he is trying to forget by drinking. In the night of Macau, there echoes out the sad, long-drawn-out sound of the bugle from the lips of the soldier guarding the fortress. Here, as at home, in our monastery after supper there is benediction in the chapel, and then the priests and brothers, candles in hand, retire to their rooms in accordance with the rule. The servants have just marched through the courtyard. In the rooms of Garp and Santa Marta the light is extinguished. Truly, this is the end of the earth. Beneath the light of the candle, I am sitting with my hands on my knees, staring in front of me, and I keep turning over in my mind the thought that I am at the end of the earth, in a place which you do not know and which your whole lives through you will never visit. A throbbing sensation fills my being, and behind my eyelids arises the memory of that long and terrible sea journey, so that my breast is filled with pain. Certainly my being in this utterly remote and unknown Oriental town is like a dream. Or rather, if I begin to reflect that it is not a dream, I feel like shouting out that it is a miracle. Is it true that I am in Macau? Am I not perhaps in a dream? I cannot believe this whole thing. On the wall is a great big cockroach. Its rasping noise breaks the solemn silence of the night. Go into the whole world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He that does not believe will be condemned. Such were the words of the risen Christ to the disciples assembled for supper. And now, as I obey this injunction, the face of Christ rises up before my eyes. What did the face of Christ look like? This point the Bible passes over in silence. You know well that the early Christians thought of Christ as a shepherd. The short mantle, the small tunic, one hand is holding the foot of the lamb while the other clasps a staff. This figure is familiar in our countries, for we see it reflected in many of the people whom we know. That was how the earliest Christians envisaged the gentle face of Christ. And then in the Eastern Church one finds the long nose, the curly hair, the black beard. All this was creating an Oriental Christ. As for the medieval artists, many of them painted a face of Christ resplendent with the authority of a king. Yet tonight, for me, the face is that of the picture preserved in Borgo San Sepulcro. There still remains fresh in my memory the time when I saw this picture as a seminarian for the first time. Christ has one foot on the sepulchre, and in his right hand he holds a crucifix. He is facing straight out, and his face bears the expression of encouragement it had when he commanded his disciples three times, "Feed my lambs, feed my lambs, feed my lambs." It is a face filled with vigour and strength. I feel great love for that face. I am always fascinated by the face of Christ, just like a man fascinated by the face of his beloved. At last, our departure is only 5 days away. We have absolutely no luggage to bring to Japan except our own hearts. We are preoccupied with spiritual preparation only. Alas, I feel no inclination to write about Santa Marta. God did not grant to our poor companion the joy of being restored to health. But everything that God does is for the best. No doubt God is secretly preparing the mission that someday will be his. Chapter 2. Letter of Sebastian Rodriguez. The peace of God, glory to Christ. Within the space of one short letter, I don't know how to speak about the innumerable events that have crowded into my life in the past 2 months. Moreover, in my present state, I do not even know if this letter will ever reach you. But my mood is such that I just cannot keep from writing, for I feel the duty of leaving you something written down. For 8 days after leaving Macau, our ship was blessed with extraordinarily fine weather. The sky was clear and blue. The sail bellied out in the wind. We could see the shoals of flying fish gleaming like silver as they leapt out of the waves. Every morning, Garp and I offered Mass on board ship, giving thanks to God for our safe passage. But it was not long until we hit up against our first storm. It was May 6th, when a strong wind began to blow from the southeast. The sailors were men of experience. They took down the sail and put up a smaller one in the front of the ship. But now it was dead of night, and the only thing possible was to abandon our ship to the winds and the waves. Meanwhile, in the front of the ship, a great rift was opened, and the water began to pour in. For almost the whole night long we worked at stuffing cloth into the rift and bailing out the water. Just as dawn was breaking, the storm ceased. The sailors, as well as Garp and myself, in utter exhaustion, could only throw ourselves down between the bales of luggage and stare up at the thick black rain clouds floating off to the east. There arose in my heart the thought of St. Francis Xavier. He also, in the calm which followed such a storm, must have looked up at the milky sky. And then, for the next 80 years, how many missionaries and seminarians had sailed around the coast of Africa, passed by India, and had crossed over this very sea to preach the gospel in Japan. There had been Bishop Chequera. There had been Organtino, Gomez, Lopez, Gregorio. If one began to count them, there was no limit. And among them there were some, like Gil da Mata, who met their fate in a sinking ship with their eyes fixed on Japan. Now I have some idea of the tremendous emotion that filled their breasts and enabled them to endure this awful suffering. All these great missionaries gazed at both the milky clouds and the thick black rain clouds floating away to the east. What thoughts filled their minds at such times? This also I can well imagine. Beside the ship's baggage was Kichijiro. I could hear his voice. During the storm, this pitiful coward made almost no attempt to help the sailors, and now, wretchedly pale, he lay between the baggage. Splashed all around him was white vomit, and he kept muttering something in Japanese. With the sailors, we looked at the fellow with contempt. We were too exhausted to be interested in his stammering Japanese, but quite by accident, jumbled in with his sentences, I caught the words Gratia and Santa Maria. This fellow, who was just like a pig that buried its face in its own vomit, had without a doubt uttered twice the words Santa Maria. Garp and I exchanged glances. Was it possible that he was of our faith, this wretch who all through the journey not only failed to help, but was even a positive nuisance? No, it was impossible. Faith could not turn a man into such a coward. Raising up a face, filthy with his own vomit, Kichijiro turned on us a glance of pain. And then, with his usual cunning, he made a pretense of not understanding the questioning looks we fixed on him. He smiled his cowardly smile. He has the most fawning, obsequious laugh you could possibly imagine. It always leaves a bad taste in our mouths. "I am asking a question," said Garp, raising his voice. "Give me a clear answer. Are you or are you not a Christian?" Kichijiro shook his head vigorously. The Chinese sailors, from their place between the bales of luggage, looked at the whole affair with a mixture of curiosity and contempt. If Kichijiro were a Christian, why did he go so far as to conceal the whole affair even from us priests? My guess was that this cowardly fellow was afraid lest on returning to Japan we might give him over to the officials, revealing the fact that he was a Christian. On the other hand,